The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Welcome to the Friday evening edition of The Money Show. Andre De Reiter, Chief Executive of Eskom, standing by to talk to you in just a moment. The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. I'm not sure if we're going to get hold of Portia Darby this evening. Portia is the Chief Executive of Transnet. I'm just looking at the results of Transnet, and they don't make for good reading. Not at all for good reading. Much of the woes of Transnet are put down to COVID-19. I'm hoping that we get to talk to her this evening, because there are a whole bunch of issues that we need to touch base with her on. So, yeah, we're standing by and hoping that she will be finished with the results that were meant to be delivered at 12:30, then at 1 o'clock, and then at 3 o'clock, and I'm told they started in the last hour. So lots of delays at Transnet this evening. We'll chat to Andre De Reiter in just a moment. We'll also this evening pick up on what happened on markets. Commodity prices came off sharply. The Rand weakening, one of the worst weeks it's had in recent times, ahead of the local government elections coming up on Monday. We'll also bring you the Brutal Biz Quiz and the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been between now and 8.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Well, good news is that load shedding will be suspended from 8 p.m. It comes after a week spent mostly in Stage 4, a night on Stage 3, and then today on Stage 2. Eskom Chief Executive Andre De Reiter, as promised, on the line to us from Johannesburg this evening. Is Eskom calling the shots on load shedding, Andre? A night on Stage 3, a day on Stage 2, after a week of Stage 4, ahead of local government elections, who is calling the shots on keeping the lights on?
At this point in time, Bruce, our poorly maintained plant is calling the shots. That is why we had load shedding in the first instance. Believe you me, if we could have avoided it, we would have, but regrettably, the lack of reliability of our system again caught up with us, and we had to implement load shedding. So this was not an orchestrated event. It was caused by a number of failures of key plant, and as a consequence, we had to go into Stage 4.
But by switching the lights on this evening and the weekend ahead of the election, is this an Eskom decision, or is this a Pravin Gordhan decision? Is it an executive decision from government, as your shareholder say, you keep those lights on no matter what happens?
No, this is entirely an Eskom decision. We have taken a look at the units that have come back from various unplanned outages. We've seen Coburg 1 ramping up quite nicely. We've recovered our diesel reserves at our open cycle gas turbines. Our pump storage looks quite good. So in view of that, and because electricity consumption over the weekend is typically lower, we feel comfortable suspending load shedding at 8 o'clock tonight.
What caused this week's collapse? Jan Overholzer, an interview earlier today, suggesting that it's sheer bloody-minded neglect on behalf of some people at Eskom at some power stations.
That certainly is one of the major reasons, Bruce. You know, when you look at the bad habits that many of our people acquired during the era of state capture, and particularly when certain of my less than illustrious predecessors were in charge of pulling various levers to enrich themselves, that embedded some very poor operational practices. And to unlearn those practices is going to require some doing. We've already made a number of management changes. Tomorrow, myself and Philip Dukashia, the group executive in charge of generation, are going to visit a number of power stations, and we will continue that visit on Sunday so that we can look those power station managers in the eye and ask them, you know, have you been walking your plant? Have you displayed visible felt leadership? Are you putting boots on the ground to make sure that your plant operates? And I suspect that that is the magic recipe. It is hands-on management, which we are not always practicing. So we are going to concentrate their minds a bit.
Yeah, this isn't the first time that you've had to do this. I mean, quite soon after you took over in early last year. We went through load shedding. You, I think, did some personal visits as well, and you read the Riot Act, and people didn't respond in the way you expected them to respond. So you fired a couple, you suspended at least one, or demoted somebody as well. I forget the detail. Surely, with that culture in place, there should have been better oversight from Eskom's head office at Megawatt Park on the power stations themselves, because power station managers are proving to be unreliable in doing the basics that you require.
I think that is part of the story. We do have a management gap, particularly at some of our power stations, where our managers do need to sharpen up the act. But bear in mind that there's an entire, call it, command structure below them. And that is where, as Jan also said in his remarks during the media conference today, where we've suffered a significant depletion of skills over the years. And, you know, one person cannot operate a power station, just as one person cannot operate the generation system. And therefore, you have to rely on the skills that you've got available. And that malaise that has crept in over the years will take time to restore. So this is not only a hardware issue, it's also a software issue.
But why don't people who work at these power stations give a damn about their jobs? Why don't they have the sort of pride that they need to have to keep the lights on? I mean, these are critical people in critical positions who are, on average, exceptionally well paid relative to most of the South African population.
It's very exasperating, Bruce. It is one of the issues that really causes me to lose sleep. It is an issue that I think leads to Eskom letting down 60 million South Africans. And that's something that I think those people who are somewhat lackadaisical don't always understand and appreciate. And that's the reason for my going there tomorrow and on Sunday and making sure that people understand that this is not the way that we expect them to behave.
Should you be firing people this weekend? Is it possible for you to fire people in those positions this weekend?
Yeah, firing people in Eskom is quite difficult.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Comes with, but all sorts of attendant issues that you need to very carefully manage. But no, I don't intend there to go and fire people. I also want to understand what are the constraints that prevent them from performing as expected. Are there issues that we can unblock for them? So this is not only about cracking the whip, it's also about learning and offering assistance. It's not always easy being a power station manager. There are some significant challenges, particularly with regard to procurement. I, for example, recently have had to obtain permission from National Treasury to spend an amount of 80,000 Rand. That permission arrived 2 months after I decided to spend it anyway. So these things complicate our lives when you try and run a 24/7 industrial operation functioning within a regulatory ecosystem.
As frustrating as that might be, I mean, it's hardly surprising that there are these constraints on spending based on the history of Eskom in the last decade or so.
That is true. I think that one has to have adequate governance and controls, but I do think that holding management accountable is probably a better solution than trying to have external parties holding on to the purse strings in a way that really constrains us from improving the system in the way that we should, given the criticality of Eskom and the fact that, in some instances, the alternative is load shedding.
Every time we have a bout of load shedding, there's at least one analyst who says, you see, this is proof that the grid is on the verge of total collapse. How much longer can we keep on keeping on in its current state? Are we on the verge of total collapse?
No, that is, unfortunately, the very reason why we implement load shedding is to avoid total collapse. We are very careful, and we've got a really world-class system operator based in Germiston, monitoring the system on a second-by-second basis. And as soon as the reserve level gets too close for comfort, they intervene, and that is when we have to impose load shedding in order to avoid that total collapse or that total blackout of the system. So, no, I don't think that that is a risk that is likely to materialize. However, given the lack of reliability of our system, the real solution, as I've been saying for just about 2 years now, is 4,000 to 6,000 megawatts of additional capacity on the grid as soon as we can. That will give us the space that we need to avoid load shedding as a way of preventing the collapse of the system.
Andre de Reiter, Chief Executive at Eskom. Deep frustration, of course, in the deep complexity. And I mean, yeah, it's so easy to make sweeping statements, as you see so often on social media, about the ineptitude of management at this thing that is broken. It is. It functions, but it is broken. And it has been broken, and it has been driven into the ground through sheer incompetence, ineptitude, and a lack of care for the better part of the last decade, like so much of so many other state institutions. Transnet, I don't think we're going to get to Transnet tonight, Portia Darby. But what we've asked her to do is to spend some time with us on Monday. We can even have a slightly longer discussion. Just a reflective look at these results that are going to come out of Transnet today, because it's another critical cog in the wheel of South Africa's fortunes. It really is. These things need to work. You cannot have a private sector provider doing what Eskom does by itself. You get a many, but you still have to have some sort of central repository of energy provision, I think, as you do with Transnet. It'd be great to have more private sector participation in Transnet. Great to have some private sector participation in Eskom, in the way that we've admitted we can't run an airline and getting private sector players in. Perhaps it's time for that to be happening more broadly within other state-owned enterprises.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
And the Rand's taken a big smack this week, and it's again hardly surprising. The lights have hardly been on, and load shedding has been regular and frustrating and energy sapping, as well as a local government election, which, considering the rage that some of you feel, is likely to change your minds on the way you vote. I hope you use that vote wisely come Monday. But the Rand is having its worst week in months after, yes, that week of load shedding and the elections. Matete Tulari is the head of foreign exchange execution at RMB. What's your reading, Matete, of the Rand at the moment?
Good evening, Bruce, and happy Friday. I suppose it's been a really long week, and as you say, the Rand has had another poor day as we've taken the losses for the week to about close to 3%. And I suppose the markets, you know, pricing in for a rate hike next month, obviously that leaves a big room for disappointment. And I suppose it's really going to make the Rand really vulnerable to sharp pullback that we've seen. Already emerging market investors this week have shown a willingness to punish a lot of the developing nations that seem to be lagging in this joining this global rate hike movement that we are starting to see. I mean, Turkey, which cuts rates at its last meeting, will see the lira conclude the month of October with its worst performance as the worst performing emerging market currency against the dollar. Brazil this week, obviously, we've seen their biggest interest rate hike in about nearly two decades, and that was still too dovish for investors this weekend. Unfortunately for the Brazilian real, it's the second worst performing emerging market currency for this month. And then the Rand, that's the number three from the bottom. I mean, already that's under pressure even before Lesetša Kganyako and team sit on the November the 18th for the last Reserve Bank meeting of the year. And already, I mean, when you just look at the FRA agreement, which is the forward rate agreement, I mean, that's pricing in around a 25 basis point hike and also pointing to about a 50% chance for a 50-point increase in interest rates come November the 18th. But I suppose if you look at just the inflation numbers, they really remain well contained within the 3 to 6 point bracket. And I think also already, you just had Andre on the line, and I suppose electricity constraints continue to erode growth prospects for the country. And I mean, these are really some of the important factors that may keep Lesetša Kganyako and team from moving interest rates up until next year. And I suppose if you just look at some of the risks for us as we go into the close of the year, I mean, already the first one being there, obviously, the electricity supply issues that will stifle economic growth. The second issue being potentially this fourth wave of COVID cases coming up in the latter part of the year into 2022. And already you've spoken about it. We've got local elections that are coming up on Monday. So that obviously is something that the international market will be looking at. And already we've even got the medium-term budget statement on November the 11th. And then a week later, you've got the Reserve Bank
You're just scaring me with risk after risk after risk. But that is, I mean, it's a really good way of illustrating the extent of why we need to become a little bit more adult and a bit more predictable in the way we run ourselves.
100%. And I suppose also, you know, the other risk to all of this is that, unfortunately, as we close up the year, you've already got the ratings agencies that are going to give us an update. So that's also going to be something that we really need to look out for. And I mean, just as a bank, we've adjusted our year-end forecast to 1480. Previously, we had said that it would be 1430 where we close off the year. But I suppose the main reason for this revision is the current risk-off environment that we are facing. And we're anticipating quite a lot of volatility that will continue into the end of 2021 and likely extend itself into the first quarter of next year. But I think from a longer-term forecast, you know, we remain largely unchanged. 1520 into the second half of next year toward the 1530 levels, which is exactly where we are at this point in time. So as you say, I mean, there's a lot of talk about reform and all these things that also need to come onto the table. And I suppose besides the risks, you know, also in the month of February next year, we've already got Enoch Godongwana already going to deliver the first budget statement of the year as well.
This stuff keeps on coming. Matete Tolari, thank you. Really nicely explained. The head of foreign exchange execution at RMB. We're not isolated. We're not an island. As much as some people would love to think we are an island, not even Cape Town is an island. You can't exclude yourself not from what's happening in South Africa. You can't isolate or insulate yourself from it. You can't insulate yourself from what's happening, in, bizarrely enough, in places like Turkey and Brazil, whose currencies are bigger basket cases than our own. But yeah, the world has had one of its worst weeks in absolutely ages, not helped by Eskom, not helped by the insecurity around what how the election is going to play out on Monday and into next week.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Tato Mashiho is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth, and we've seen a very sharp sell-off in commodity prices. I wonder just how significant a factor that is in not just the markets at the moment, but in terms of our ability to keep earning the high levels of foreign exchange, which are improving tax collections and you know, really helping the finance minister ahead of his medium-term budget policy statement on the 11th of November. Sorry, I'm so used to Zoom calls, Tato, that I forget to put people on because we can't rely on those too much anymore either, so we use the old-fashioned telephone. Sorry, so lots of factors influencing what's happening, not only in markets, but the real economy at the moment.
Well, indeed, sometimes the tried and tested technology does work the best.
We'll send a pigeon and you can send your answers via a quill-written letter next time. So Tato, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on at the moment which is big and hairy and causing havoc in markets.
Indeed, there's so many factors going on. And you mentioned commodity prices. And we've seen futures for quite a lot of the base metals coming off recently. As you well know, that there's been quite a few supply chain bottlenecks, specifically in China, and demand for steel and a few other metals which play into our commodity basket via iron ore and coal and so on have come down somewhat. And that is concerned, but I suppose we always knew that the first half boom that we saw in commodities wasn't likely to continue at the same pace throughout the rest of the year. And whilst it's been positive for tax receipts and foreign exchange, as you say, we're really hoping that the minister can sort of put a ceiling on spending and reintroduce fiscal consolidation that we used to see a few years ago.
Yeah, okay. But then, but despite the environment in which we are operating, there really are some interesting trading updates coming through. A good quarterly trading update coming through from Distell today. Do they tell us anything about Heineken and its approach for Distell?
Well, I didn't have a close look at the Distell release in particular, but we have seen quite a few releases recently from some of the global beverage players, such as Altria in the US, which unfortunately did miss on its volume expectations. And we've seen some release recently from the likes of Anheuser, seeing positive volumes from Latin America, which has performed reasonably well. Obviously, other regions, due to various lockdown restrictions, have limited beverage volumes, but they continue to, I suppose, strive to pay down debt and reposition the group going forward. But I haven't had as close a look at the Distell numbers, unfortunately.
I can tell you that they're very good. And despite losing something like 20, 25 days to lockdowns and booze bans, their performance is rocking. They're really doing very nicely. And it's like their customers have learned to navigate all of the obstacles that government keeps throwing at them. But I do wonder, and there's no mention of Heineken, by the way, I do wonder if Heineken's waiting to see the political landscape after this local election and to see where the shifts are before they make a final offer. Because they must be keen because they're still talking. The Foschini Group, though, you did have a good close look at that. And that's also, considering the riots in July, considering all of that stuff, it is really surprising that they are performing as well as they are.
Well, it is. And I suppose it speaks to an extent to some of the resilience in our local counters. We've seen fairly strong performance from a few retailers recently, and Foschini doesn't seem to be an exception to that. They do estimate that they'll lose around 600 million rand in turnover from the riot, but nevertheless, group sales were very positive, about 18% year on year, specifically in South Africa and, I suppose, the broader Africa region, up 28%. Australia was significantly weaker due to the severe lockdown restrictions we saw in the second quarter in various parts of the country. The UK seems to be recovering quite well. When you dive through into the different segments, the clothing, which shouldn't be a surprise, was very strong, up 37%. Homeware as well, a trend we've seen across all the different retailers with people upgrading their homes due to working from home. So overall, fairly strong. Less credit being extended, which was one interesting fact, which I suppose is somewhat of a read-through to broader credit extension, which makes sense. A company is not really keen on opening the lending taps at the moment.
My thanks to Tato Mashiko this evening, Portfolio Manager at Sunlum Private Wealth. Wrapping up today's markets, commodity prices under pressure, the oil price stubbornly high, the currency weaker. Next week, we're getting a fuel price increase. I saw the economist Mike Schussler today saying, we're going to get a fuel price increase. What's the bet? It's announced after the election. And I think it will be, because you don't want to upset people even more than you already have this week. I've got a very key and fundamental belief that there is opportunity even where there is chaos and dysfunction. Goldman Sachs has made about $100 million after buying Steinhoff debt. Now, Steinhoff debt was massively distressed, of course, and so it took a risk and it bought this debt, and the value of the debt rebounded. And so it got the loans in the company. Excuse me, when a hedge fund called CQS was dumping the debt last year, and it just had to find any buyer. And Goldman Sachs picked it up, and it is a bit of swings and roundabouts, of course, because Goldman Sachs was forced to take an impairment of $130 million on its loan to Steinhoff in 2017. So this has made up a large chunk of that impairment as a result. Still about $30 million down. But Goldman Sachs taking a risk on Steinhoff, and that risk does seem to have paid off this time around.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
Welcome to The Money Show. We're going to talk to jeweler Karen Ray Matier this evening. Looking forward to that in our Friday file. We'll also play the Brutal Biz quiz in between 7 and 8 what we will do is bring you some of the best bits of The Money Show from the week that has been. But before we do that, on the next Money Show, it's our special Election Day broadcast, but our regulars are in place. Other People's Money will be with Stephen Van Coller, how to pull a rabbit out of a hat and prevent a company from going to the wall. The chief executive of EOH, as that company turns around. And Greg Mills, in his brand new book, Expensive Poverty, Why Aid Fails and How It Can Work. Critical discussions happening next time on The Money Show. Plus, of course, keeping you up to speed with whatever's happening in the local government elections.
The Money Show.
The Friday File.
The Friday File.
Have you ever watched a jeweler work? They work with intense heat and blow torches and soldering irons and scalding metals and precious stones. It is astounding to watch the process. It is a thing of beauty. And you watch this beautiful work of art emerge from this pile of raw materials, and it is painstaking and detailed work. Karen Ray Mattia is with us this evening. She's been doing it for more than a decade. What got you started?
Hello, thanks for having me. I started when I was 10 years old, actually. My dad had a little jewelry hobby bench, and I was very intrigued by it. So he taught me how to cut little shapes out of metal when I was 10 years old. So I've been going for quite a long time.
At what time, how old were you when you could use blow torches and soldering irons and, you know, all of the fun stuff?
Probably when I started studying at Stellenbosch. Okay. I studied jewelry design at Stellenbosch.
Your dad was helpful, not crazy, which is good to know.
Yes.
So he was he just a part-time hobbyist and used to play at jewelry making, and that enabled you then, gave you access to the toys and tools, and then built a passion inside you?
Yes, exactly. He was actually a civil engineer and did it as a hobby. And it was just so intriguing to me and so wonderful to think of making something that would last forever, you know, like in this magical metal. I really just loved the whole concept of it, and I loved working with my hands. So yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Do you still have any of those pieces that you made back then? How do you rate them?
I do actually have a box of funny old bits and bobs of pieces that I did.
And do you rate them? Do you look back at yourself and say, hey, I was quite good at that?
Lots of the lines are quite skew and jagged, but yeah, it's really fun to see what I did when I was younger. Yeah, I'm glad I still have them as memories.
You go to Stellenbosch and you study there, but you'd also get to do a brief stint in Germany. Was that important?
Yeah, it's hugely important. I think that shifted my whole mentality. And I think what it really did was made me realize that I wanted to come back to South Africa and start my own business. Because I realized that in Germany, things were quite sort of strict and there's a lot of red tape. And I was like, sure, actually going back home and starting my own business doesn't seem as daunting as it did initially. So I was also quite passionate about employment and creating jobs. That was a big driving force for me.
So what's your setup today? I mean, you've got a workshop in Cape. Is it a workshop or is it a, I don't know, what is it, an atelier? I don't know what it is.
So I'm not as fancy. I don't call it an atelier. It's definitely a workshop. but we have a space in Bree Street, which is a shop space as well as a workshop. So everything happens all together, which is wonderful. And we currently are 14 full-time people and 20 all together working together. Yeah. Creating jewelry and running the retail store and doing the marketing.
That's an astonishing number of people. It's not an answer I expected, quite frankly. And that is testament then to a decade of slog. I mean, how do you reach your customer? Is it a walk by thing? Or are you active on Instagram and other places?
So we are very active on Instagram, and I think we've been lucky enough. We joined Instagram at a time when it was quite easy to build a community. But I also have an amazing marketing team that put together an incredible sort of selection of images, and we do lots of shoots, and we kind of encourage our community to engage with us as much as we can in our shop and then as well as online. So luckily, with COVID hitting, we actually already had a very strong online platform, which really actually saved the day for us because we obviously couldn't have people in store.
Yeah, I mean, and it's amazing how many people have made that digital transition. Do you find it hard? Or has it been just like this? Why didn't I do this sooner?
Well, we did have quite a strong following, I think, as a South African brand before COVID. So I think that really helped. But yeah, it's been amazing to see how the online platform has just carried us. And I do often think, like, why didn't we just invest more and more into this online platform before? But I think it took a while for everybody to shift. You know, I felt like South Africa was quite behind on shopping online, and now people have been forced into it and are, I think, quite enjoying it. So yeah.
How do you buy something so intimate and personal as jewelry online? It strikes me as clothing sizes are hard enough, you know, shoe sizes are hard enough in different cuts and stuff.
Yeah.
But a piece of jewelry can look magnificent on one hand or around one neck and just not work around another.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, and sizing is quite a thing. So we actually have created this little like paper belt that we send with orders for people to wrap around their fingers to figure out what ring size they are. So that is quite a big hurdle to get over, is your ring size. And then, yeah, I think just taking really good photos and getting feedback from customers in terms of what they need to, you know, make that decision. We also try create quite a big, to create a space in our retail store that really welcomes people in, even with this COVID kind of time, so that they can really touch and feel and try on, because I think that is really important. So I think why we do sell a lot online is because people trust our brand, and because we've been going so long, and they might already have a piece or two, so they trust to purchase another piece, you know. But yeah, you are right. It's tricky.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to venture a view, because I don't want to insult you, but I mean, your work looks classic and clean and pure. I think those are positive comments. I don't know if you would interpret it the same way. But I look at the beautiful simplicity of your design, and it really looks like you designed to show off the jewel. The metals you use are the vehicle to carry the jewels that you display in the pieces I see.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, and we only use solid metals, which has also been a decision I made from the beginning, to not use any plated metals, so people can wear it every day. So my whole idea is that the designs are very clean and simple, and it's kind of encouraging a concept of everyday luxury, where people can feel like they can wear a gold ring to work or to just hang around at home. They don't have to wait for that dress-up evening. And just really encouraging people, creating more accessibility around gold and solid silver.
And then you seem to have a very strong ethos. I mean, you say you came back home from Germany realizing that you could actually carve a particular furrow in the jewelry market in South Africa. You wanted to create jobs, and you've done that with 20 people. But I saw a piece written about you, and you were talking about how you divide up your week, which I looked at this and I went, you are super organized. And actually, to do this, you have to be massively disciplined. Do you stick to Mentorship Monday, Creative Tuesday, Admin Wednesday? You still have to be admin never. And Boss Thursday, Collaborative Friday. These are wonderful terms, but does it help you structure your week in terms of creating a discipline for you to work inside?
I mean, I think it initially helped me to allow me to wear the different hats and let go of the one, you know, of wearing so many hats all at the same time. So that's why I structured my week like that. But I must say, it has become more fluid since I did that. And I think it's because I now feel more confident to just focus on admin on the one day and, you know, creativity on another day. And I think the reason why I did that was because I wasn't really creating space for my creativity as much as I needed to. And then like the admin and the business side was taking all my energy. So yeah, it really has worked, wearing hats on different days.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, how have you managed the business side as somebody who's creative and somebody who leads a team creating beautiful things? So often the big problem is making that transition to actually running the business of making what you produce possible.
Yes. So how do I do that?
Yes.
I have an incredible team, I must say. I think if I may say so myself, I think I am good at choosing and a good team and kind of placing people in the right positions to make it all work well together. And I think that's why DRA has been so successful, is that I have really good people in the right positions. And I think I've employed people that are better than me in those roles. You know, like I'm a terrible photographer, you know, so I've employed someone who's really good at that. And just focusing more on the team elements has allowed me to achieve a lot more than what I could have ever dreamed of doing on my own, you know. So I think that, yeah, just having a great team has been the main focus. And then I think I've also had a lot of incredible mentors who've guided me along the way, because I think it can be a very lonely path to walk, running your own business, and specifically a creative business. But yeah, it's been a really interesting and fulfilling journey. I love it. I think if I only did the jewelry creative work, I think I would never have been as stimulated. So very grateful for both.
It's a wonderful story. Karen Ray Mathieu. Dear Ray is the business, and she makes beautiful jewelry and has created these jobs and is creating that level of inspiration, which is so admirable. On our Friday file, wonderful story to have heard. Thank you very much for sharing with us. Brutal Biz Quiz coming up in just a moment. Slightly higher grade question, but if you apply your mind to the news of the week, you should be able to have a good stab at it. Name the first junk-rated company to hit a $1 trillion valuation. There's a company which this week hit $1 trillion, but it's rated junk, but it still got there. There's hope for us. 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. The first company to be rated junk to hit $1 trillion valuation. What is the name of that company? Do please give us a shout and let us play the Brutal Biz Quiz.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show is proudly brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, the bank that brings you the 2021 Absa Africa Financial Markets Index. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show. Brutal Biz Quiz time. Akvar is up first from Krugersdorp this evening. The first junk-rated company to hit a $1 trillion valuation is, Akvar.
Tesla.
Is absolutely right. Yep. It's the first junk-rated company. Its debt may still be considered speculative grade, but it's his value. It's a company is worth $1 trillion, and it's made Elon Musk filthy, filthy rich. Which is the world's most valuable company as of this afternoon, Akva?
Oh, this afternoon, I'm going to go with Tesla again. I'm not sure.
Hook, line, and sinker. Caught out. I'm afraid not, Akbar. Let's try Keith in Pretoria this evening. The most valuable company as of this afternoon in the world is, Keith.
Apple.
It was yesterday, but not this afternoon. Rich in Pretoria.
Microsoft
is absolutely right. Microsoft passed Apple's market cap, making it the world's most valuable traded company. Apple missed its earnings expectations yesterday, and as a result, it slipped. Microsoft rose, and the tide has turned. No, it hasn't. We'll see. It's really interesting. I love the fact that they're vying for top spot. What does the COP, Rich, the COP in COP26, what does COP stand for?
Conference on,
I'm afraid, Rich. Well, you've gone halfway there. Thank you. Conference of the what? Not Conference of the People, because Congress of the People, that's COPE. But this is Conference of the What? Bunny in Pretoria. Lots of Pretoria calls this evening, which is lovely. Thank you, Pretoria.
Yeah, I was noticing the Pretoria calls. Bruce, I wouldn't know for the life of me, but let me take a shot. Conference on pollution.
No, conference of the what? 011-883-0702-021-446-0567. You got a minute or two to give us a call, or I win this evening's round of the Brutal Biz Quiz. Unless Norvan in Midrand, close to Pretoria, can... Oh, Norvan's run away. So do you want me to be the whiz of the biz quiz? I'm very happy to take the title of whiz of the brutal biz quiz. This is like the most important global event. It's an event where the world is getting together. Parties from all over the place are getting together. And they're going to be discussing your grandchildren's future. And nobody knows what it stands for. To be honest, I didn't know until this week either. So it wouldn't be entirely fair. In Sandown, Becky.
Hi, Bruce. Conference of the Planet.
I wish I could give it to you, but I'm afraid you're not. Sorry, Becky. Oh, I've got to have this one. Let's see if you live up to your name, clever in Eden Vale.
Yes. Conference of the Parties.
You, clever, have lived up to your name. I'm not going to ask you a second question because I don't want to prove you wrong. Clever in Eden Vale, at the death, Conference of the Parties. 3 decades, the United Nations has been bringing together almost every country on Earth most years to talk about the climate crisis. It's called COP's Conference of the Parties, and it starts in Glasgow. Everyone's flying in on big gas-guzzling jets. But hey, they've got to get there somehow. Conference of the Parties. Clever. Well done to you, living up to your name. In a moment, we'll bring you some of the best bits from The Money Show this week. Looking forward to sharing those with you after Eyewitness News at 7.